You're on a GLP-1, but now you're wondering, how do I manage my side effects? What do I eat to stay strong? Because reaching your weight loss goals can take more than meds. That's where Weight Watchers Med Plus comes in. Get access to trusted experts, food plans that work with your body, and habit coaching to keep you on track. Plus access to GLP-1 medication. Get started at WeightWatchers.com. All medical services are provided through our affiliated medical group, Weight Watchers Clinic. Medications require eligibility and prescription. Individual results may vary. See site for more details.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined in my partner in all things strategy, grand and not so grand, Elliot Cohen, the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Elliot, how are you?
Well, I'm good because we have another Bostonian on at long last. And actually, we can kind of ditch the main topics we're going to talk about and instead talk about those socks, but maybe not. Seriously, I'm really delighted we have our guest, who you'll be introducing in a moment, who's written really what I think is one of the finest diplomatic memoirs I've ever read. But over to you, Eric.
Well, our guest is Ambassador John J. Sullivan, former Deputy Secretary of Commerce, former Deputy Secretary of State in the Bush 43 and Trump administrations, respectively, and then Ambassador to the Russian Federation, both under President Trump and under President Biden. His memoir is Midnight in Moscow, a memoir from the front lines of Russia's war against the West. I'm old enough to remember another memoir by one of your maybe less distinguished predecessors, Mission to Moscow by Joseph Davies, which was then made into a film, Inter Alia. He was married to Marjorie Meatherweather Post, who owned a small, modest home in Florida.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Mar-a-Lago. Yeah.
That's it.
And his memoir was a whitewash, really, of Joseph Stalin and the Purge trials. It was made into a kind of popular kind of propagandistic movie during World War II. Your memoir, Ambassador Sullivan, is anything but. It really is, and, you know, given your background as an attorney, it is, I would say, an indictment of Putin's launching of an aggressive war, a very powerful one. But I wanted to first thank you for joining us, but ask you about, you know, how you thought about managing the post. Because as someone who served in Embassy Moscow in the late 1980s, I always, as a foreign service officer, always believed that we had to exact very explicit reciprocity in how we managed the embassy. You did that, and that's not all that common. So welcome, and tell us how you did it.
Well, thanks, Eric. Elliot, it's great to be with you, a fellow resident of the Commonwealth and loyal member of Red Sox Nation. I tried, Eric. I failed. The reasons are varied. I was briefed extensively by my predecessor, Ambassador John Huntsman. In fact, Huntsman's valedictory cable, which was classified, was basically laying out how we're going to lose this very important embassy soon, or how it's going to be compromised by the Russian security services. It was one of the many challenges that made the post attractive to me. When I went in to explain to Secretary Pompeo why I was going to leave him as in my role as deputy secretary, because I wanted to go to Moscow, asking his permission and his intervention with the president. And he asked me why, and I told him, I said, you know, the challenge, the fact that it's not easy dealing with the FSB, which smothers the American embassy in Moscow the way the KGB did. The FSB is the principal successor, along with the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, of the KGB. But standing up to their thuggery in that counterintelligence environment, appeal to Elliot, the Boston Irish cop that lurks in my, my inner soul, right? You can't do that to us. My frustrations and my lack, what little success I had in trying to, and by the way, the Russians respected this. If you go in and you're mailing, they lose all respect and treat Americans with contempt. And, you know, I would go in, I would not be belligerent. I wasn't pounding the table. I would go in and comport myself more in sorrow than in anger and tell them things. Never, ever ask for things. Tell them things. If you don't do X, we will do Y. Neither of us wants this. You don't want it. I don't want it. But you leave me no choice. So it's up to you. The problem I had, the bigger, I won't say enemy, the frustration was with my colleagues back in Washington. And the explanation, it's they wanted to be helpful. They just had trouble conceptualizing the, and I will say in this case, enemy. That's what Putin describes us as, the United States and our vassals in NATO and in the West. They had trouble conceptualizing that we were, and this is in late 2019, early 2020, there wasn't a major war in Ukraine ongoing at the time. It was on a low boil. But the bureaucracy, the Office of Foreign Missions, were just not configured, and they didn't have the right mindset to treat the Russians. And I'm not talking about exact reciprocity. And I'll give you an example. We had, it's closed recently, the Anglo-American School, great academic institution. When I was there, all of our children from kindergarten through high school went to the Anglo-American School. We had school buses going back and forth to the school, taking the students in the morning, bringing them back in the afternoon. And one day, one of the buses was stopped by nominally a police officer, a safety inspection. I think a taillight was out, and they proceeded to search every one of the elementary school children on the bus, their backpacks, light pat downs. You know, imagine how you'd feel if your 5, 6, 7, 8 year old were subject to that.
Those Millie men are pretty intimidating too.
Exactly. And, you know, this is during the pandemic. They've got masks. I mean, it would be scary for anyone, let alone school age children. I didn't call Washington and say, you got to frisk young children walking out of the Russian embassy. We don't do that. We're Americans. And I got used to saying that, by the way, and was proud to say it. But we got to tighten the screws on these guys. And I'd get reports from our country team. And I want to credit, I mean, the country team we had in Moscow, it was very strong and it was unified. Part of it may have been because I had worked at the Defense Department for Secretary Rumsfeld, the Justice Department under Attorney General, his first time as AG, Bill Barr. I knew their bureaucracy. So for the LEGAT, the defense attaché officers, we spoke the same language. I understood, what their agencies needed, what their view was. And as a result of it, we supported each other. And there weren't silos. There wasn't a State Department versus the rest of the U.S. government thing going on. So I'd hear from the FBI that, geez, you're not going to believe this, sir. Last night, a local county sheriff in Washington State pulls over a car that the driver is pie-eyed, weaving all over the road. And it happens to be a Russian diplomat who's assigned to the United Nations on the other side of the country. And oh, by the way, he's traveling near our naval station, right? I'm like, how could this possibly have happened? How could you let Russians travel like that? They smother us. We can't travel anywhere. Very frustrating. Very, very frustrating. It was difficult to get the bureaucracy to smother in a lawful, moral, but reciprocal way the Russian embassy, their two consulates, which they have. We don't have any. No reciprocity there. was very, very challenging. So I tried my best, but I met the enemy and the enemy was us.
Yeah, but I mean, you deserve enormous credit for taking that on. I mean, as you were speaking, I feel you, bro, as they say.
Can I just ask you a quick question? Just on that, was the problem, make it sound as if the problem is the career bureaucracy. Did the politicals get involved at all? And did they seem to understand it? Or?
I never focused on career versus politicals. And for OFM, I mean, we had a pretty good political who was running OFM. It was just a mindset. And maybe it's not unique to the State Department. It may be an American mindset to not recognize, because then there isn't a state of war between the United States and Russia. We're just not built to do to a foreign embassy, a foreign mission, what they do to us. It's not just name calling when Putin says we're the enemy and that we started a war against Russia in Ukraine, which is why he needed to launch his humanitarian special military operation. It's not just name calling. It's operationalized through the FSB, and we just can't bring we're just not constituted to do that. There would be one-offs. I'd shame people. That makes me sound like the good guy, they're the bad. Just educating people, like, you need to do this not only to protect the security of the United States. Why are you letting these two Russian military officers, why were they pulled over in, heading toward Norfolk, a separate case, far outside of the D.C. Region? And, we messed up. And the FBI has neither the bandwidth nor the real enthusiasm for the counterterrorism mission. No special agent gets promoted because, they prevented some Russian diplomat from, traveling toward, our naval station in Jacksonville. As I've learned and gotten to know the FBI over decades, yeah, they like catching spies, but the day-to-day grunt work that the FSB specializes in, their counterintelligence unit of the FSB, DCRO 1, the rough estimate we have, that's 7,000 officers dedicated just to smothering our embassy in Washington. The total population of the FBI is like 35 or 40,000. 350,000 people in the FSB. They're configured to do it. That's what they do, and we don't.
Yep. You also were really a hero of capitalist labor in standing up for American citizens, unjustly detained in Russia, Paul Whelan, Trevor Reed, Brittany Griner, others. And so I really commend you on that. We could probably spend all day on that, but I would just commend to our viewers and listeners that they read those parts of your memoir. But I do want to talk about, before I kick it over to Elliot to raise some other issues, a very particular part of your time there, which was, which you described, the arrival of the intelligence in the fall of 2021 that Putin was planning his special military operation. And then a very, for any ambassador, I think, having their predecessor show up while they're there is always a little bit awkward. But in your case, one of your predecessors was also the director of Central Intelligence and came on a special mission. So can you talk a little bit about what you think the successes and failures were of the effort to declassify intelligence in order to deter President Putin? I mean, sort of some things we did deter, false flag, claims of chemical weapons attacks by Ukraine, other things, but obviously not the invasion of Ukraine. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So to set the scene, Biden and Putin meet in June, I think it was June 16th of 2021 in Geneva. And what did they not talk about? Ukraine. They spent much more time talking about Afghanistan than talking about Ukraine. Putin didn't raise it. There are a couple of sentences over the course of a day that the Ukrainians, this is Biden, we want the Minsk agreements implemented, et cetera. And Putin never raises it, right? Talked a lot about other things, the Arctic, wrongfully detained Americans, Navalny, you name it, not so much Ukraine. We then engage, we, the United States and the Russians engage. Oh, and by the way, Putin, his attitude at that meeting, as I describe in the book, was relaxed. He was cracking jokes. He was on his game. And we started work streams coming out of that meeting. So we had strategic security dialogue, which continued. I started it or resumed it in 2019 as deputy secretary with Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov. And then my successor, Wendy Sherman, picked it up. We had started a strategic security dialogue, building off of the extension, the five-year extension of the New START Treaty. We had a dialogue on climate change. Secretary Kerry came for several days in July about climate change. We had a cyber dialogue led by the White House. I was in charge of the dialogue on wrongfully detained Americans. So it was, as I say in the book, and this is how the White House described it, we're looking for guardrails, putting guardrails on the U.S.-Russia relationship, work with them where they can, where we can, and oppose them where we must. And out of the blue, at the end of October, I happened to be home on leave at the end of October, and I was called into a meeting with Secretary Blinken, and then he took me into a civets led by the White House, where they started to lay out the details of, because there had already been, as you'll recall, a buildup in southwestern Russia and Crimea in the spring, actually starting before the spring, late winter into the spring. The Russians, of course, denied that they were looking to invade Ukraine. In May, late April, they announced that these were exercises and that many of the troops were going back to their garrisons. By the end of October, the numbers had increased dramatically. Some of the troops had gone back to their garrisons, but now they returned. The infrastructure that they had built in the spring was enhanced. Fuel depots, ammo depots, field hospitals. They were doing things that a nation's military wouldn't do. These weren't preparations for exercises. They were ready for action. And so it was, as you, Eric, and you, Elliot, know, it's very difficult to get our intelligence community to agree consensus with a high degree of confidence on a conclusion. And their advice to Biden was, he's going to do it. He's really going to do it this time. So Biden sends Bill Burns, then the director of CIA, to Moscow. I was in D.C., so I flew with him. He stayed with me at Spaso House. By the time we got there, it was November 2nd. And he conveyed, after consultations with the president, a strong message to the Russian government. We met first with Nikolai Patrushev, who was then the secretary of the Security Council. Burns met with the heads of Bortnikov and Naryshkin, the heads of the FSB and the SVR. And then we spoke to Vova, the big shot. We thought it was going to be a meeting, and we learned that he was in fact in Sochi, and was done by a video conference from the Kremlin. He spends less time there now, and when he does travel, or he doesn't like, you know, he does. It's not even for security reasons. It's back then it was political reasons. It's not a good look for him to be in his billion-dollar palace when there's 2 feet of snow in Moscow. So he's had rooms configured to look like rooms in his residences around Moscow and at the Kremlin.
So Russian.
So, yeah, absolutely. And the attitude, as I summarize in the book, was Burns's message was, we see what you're going to do. Don't do it. The consequences for Russia are going to be staggering. Economic sanctions, unlike anything the world has ever seen, and certainly much more than what happened in 2014, export controls, Russia will be isolated, will be set back to, the whole litany. And I found it most revealing, Patrushev's reaction. So Patrushev, we go in to his office in his conference room, and I'd met with him before in his conference room. It's not in the Kremlin, but it's adjacent to the Kremlin. And he spoke first as the host, even though we had asked for the meeting. And he had notes in front of him, and he read from them. And it was the usual Russian litany of, it's such a shame that the U.S.-Russia relationship is in such bad shape, and it's all your fault, Ambassador Burns, you and the United States. I hope you're coming to tell me how the United States is going to try to improve our dreadful relationship. Bill then, and he reads this. Bill then gives him his spiel. Patrushev has more paper in front of him. He pushes it aside and just looks at Burns and says, and I summarize, we're not going to invade Ukraine, but if there's a problem in our neighborhood, our military is much different now, Ambassador, from when you served here. We've invested a lot. We're as strong, or maybe even in some areas stronger than the United States military is. So, yeah, the Soviet Union, Russia, the Russian Federation isn't the Soviet Union. We're not an economic colossus. You could hit us hard with sanctions, but we're Russians and our military is back. And in any event, we're not going to invade Ukraine. So we have no plans to. So thanks for your interest and, you know, hope you enjoy your stay in Moscow. Putin says virtually the same thing, although he said something telling that I thought had some impact later in decisions made about deployment, particularly of the U.S. Navy in the Black Sea. He said at one point to Bill early in the conversation, he said, my people tell me, Ambassador, that there's a U.S. Navy warship over the horizon that could kill me in a matter of minutes with your sophisticated missiles. So who's talking about whose security here? And Bill, of course, reports all that back, and that had an impact. I don't recall it ever being publicly disclosed, but in January, you talk about self-deterrence, in January of 22, so more than a month before the invasion, our SACUR at the time, General Walters, had a deployment policy of heel-to-toe deployments. U.S. warship leaves the Black Sea, cruiser, destroyer, replacement, it goes right in, heel-to-toe deployments. And I remember a question came up, it was a deputies committee meeting, and a question came up about, you know, what ships we had deployed in the Black Sea and what missiles they were carrying and was that threatening, et cetera, et cetera. No more discussion. And the next thing I knew, I'd heard through my friends in Mons that we were no longer sending in U.S. warships into the Black Sea. Now, the Turks have a role, right? Controlling the Straits, the Montreux Convention. But this was a decision by the White House that we were not going to continue those deployments that General Walters had been, you know, doing virtually his whole tenure as SACUR. And that was never publicly disclosed, but it's an example of the self-deterrence. And it grows out of, I believe, when Bill goes and reports that Putin says that, the sensitivity about the Black Sea. No one would listen to me when I said there's more NATO coastline in the Black Sea than Russian coastline, even if you include, as you shouldn't, but even if you include Crimea. They didn't want to hear that. So to get back to your original question, Eric, for Bill, he's the great one, as I called him. There's a reason that the largest auditorium at the Department of State is the Burns Auditorium. So I was honored to have him as a guest in his former residence. But the Russians maintained, I call it sham diplomacy, and I can cite a lot of examples, but I know you want to talk about other things. But that was the start. I mean, just lying to our faces. Within weeks of those meetings, Putin, and I recall this vividly because we pay attention to, Putin visits usually toward the end of the year the foreign ministry and gives an address. And so at the end of November, so a few weeks after Burns was, it was just after Thanksgiving, not that many months after Putin had met with Biden in Geneva, where he didn't raise Ukraine, Ukraine is an existential threat to the Russian Federation that requires immediate security guarantees in the form of treaties between the United States and Russia and NATO and Russia. And if those guarantees aren't given to their satisfaction, they will need to address through military technical means, their phrase, their security. So as I look back, the fact that if there really were a legitimate security concern of the Russian Federation, whether it was generally in Europe or in Ukraine in particular, the opportunity to raise that, including one-on-one with Biden, was in June of 2021. He had already decided by then what he was going to do. If Ukraine capitulated, fine. But if not, he had his goals, which he's repeated over and over again since before, just as the war was starting, to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine.
I had not heard that story about suspending the heel-to-toe deployments to the Black Sea. Unfortunately, it's one more in a whole series of things. You know, I just saw there's an excerpt from Bob Woodward's book about us asking the Russians, you know, what would cause you to use nuclear weapons? So guess what? The Russians begin telling us things to scare us off of supporting Ukraine. And unfortunately, I think that still works. I have two questions I'd like to put to you. One is, I think you allude to this in the memoir, that the sudden withdrawal from Afghanistan and the kind of chaos of that made an impression on the Russians. I wonder if you could just expand on that, and then I've got a different kind of question.
Yeah, so I'm often asked, you know, wasn't it Afghanistan that really convinced Putin that he should invade Ukraine? I say that's not my assessment. Which is not to say that Afghanistan didn't factor into what happened into the lead up to the war. And I cite in my book, a week before the terrorist attack at HKIA at the airport, the Kabul airport, Patrushev gives an interview to Russian state media, I forget which, and in Russian, he speaks only Russian, and is addressed to the Ukrainian people. And he says, in effect, I can't understand why my Slavic sisters and brothers, why you are think you're going to get any security from the United States. Look what they're doing to their major non-NATO ally in Kabul. You think they're not going to leave you twisting in the wind? They're never going to sacrifice for you. And so my assessment is, given putting it all in context with the meeting in Geneva, the diplomacy before and after that, leading up to the start of the war, to the extent we were working in November, December, January, and early February to deter Putin, he had already decided to invade. If there was an opportunity to dissuade him, to deter him, Afghanistan cut the legs out of that. He was already convinced to do it, and this he just doubled down that, you know, These folks in the United, they can't get out of their own way. And they've got, I mean, he insulted Biden, and I explain this in the book, at his press conference. It's subtle, but it's a very good KGB shiv in the back, right? He says about Biden, he's asked, for his first question that he's asked by state media is, what have you talked about Ukraine? The next question is, and of course, if it's state media, it's Putin asking himself the question. The next question is, what do you think about Biden? Oh, he's very experienced. He's a man of good moral character. He tells me lots of stories about his mother and what his mother says. And, you know, they're not relevant to anything we're talking about, but it reveals that he's got a good heart. I was standing next to Biden. We're watching the TV when he said that. And I'm thinking, a Czechist like Putin says that? I mean, that's about as black a mark against your name as you can have. And we Americans think, oh, he's so his mother. Anyway, Putin was set to do it, and he thought he had a mark in the White House who was just never going to push back sanctions. Yeah. Putin, by the way, in It was late March or April, another of 22 after the war starts, is asked in an interview with state media, friendly questioner, why did you wait until February of 22? And he said without hesitation, we weren't ready. And I interpret what he was saying was not just militarily, but stealing themselves, their economy, their supply chains for the sanctions and export controls that they expected, and that, you know, the means with which they have kept the Russian economy propped up in a way that is going to, transforming the Russian economy into a wartime economy, but in ways that are going to, there's money flowing into the bank accounts of average Russians, particularly if they've had relatives killed in Ukraine, and the budgets are going up and defense spending is going up. But the prime rate set by the central bank is 21%. And, you know, I draw the analogy to the United States in the 60s and 70s with fighting the war in Vietnam and the Great Society growth. The inflation that we then suffered in the 70s and into the early 80s, the economic dislocation, that's going to hit them on steroids. It may not be next year or even 4 years from now, but it's coming.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So a different kind of question. I think one of the great things about the memoir is you have wonderful word portraits of some of your interlocutors, of Putin, of course, but also people like Patrushev and Ryabkov and Lavrov. And I was wondering if you could kind of step back a bit and talk about that ruling class, what kinds of people they are, what their strengths are, but also what their weaknesses are. Because, you know, it seemed to me, no matter what happens to Putin, and sooner or later, you know, he's mortal, those are the people we're going to be dealing with for a long time, maybe forever. And it would be better if we all had a good understanding of what they're like as a class. I'll just mention, you know, there's one episode I remember that really struck me is you're having this argument with Ryabkov and he's turning beet red and he's yelling and screaming. Yeah. And stuff. And then he comes down and, you know, he shakes hands and stuff.
Right.
But like, sort of, and then Patrushev was kind of paranoid and crazy.
Right.
Lizard-like. So if you could do a word portrait of.
Oh, that's of a that. Good one. Lizard-like. Oh, I like that. I hadn't used that before. Do you mind if I use that in the future? I'll attribute it to you.
Ambassador, it's the least I can do in recognition of your service.
Yeah, you know, Elliot, it's people ask me all the time, well, you know, once Putin goes, won't things change? And I said, well, the war's not going to end. And yeah, they may change, and they may change for the worse. I can't tell you how many Russians, including pro-Z, pro-war Russians, who've told me you should be careful what you wish for. You replace Vladimir Vladimirovich and you may get somebody who is less inclined to constrain the crazies in their system, who might be more willing than Putin is, in my opinion, to use a nuclear weapon or an unconventional weapon. But Elliot, you said something earlier that struck me when we were chatting before this podcast started, that I wanted to follow up on. And it's not a question to you, but an observation about the Russians and their system. It is implacable, the animosity and the adversity. And I've had, you know, Russians, educated, sophisticated, westernized Russians who are Russian patriots, who've told me things like, you have no idea how deep down in our soul the loss in the Cold War really affected us, and how you treated us in the 90s. And Putin epitomizes that, but he hasn't generated this feeling. He is a product of it. He's marshaled it. He's used it. But this is, General Cavoli, I think, signed our current SACUR, summed it up a couple of months ago. He said, you know, no matter what, whether there's a ceasefire, frozen conflict in Ukraine, we're going to have a large heavily armed and angry Russia on Europe's eastern border, no matter what, and no matter whether Vladimir Putin is president of the Russian Federation or not. He brings out all the worst tendencies as himself, the lead Czechist KGB trained. And as he has said, there's no such thing as a former KGB man. But it's around the edges. It's not the ultimate thrust of restoring Russia to its rightful place. And what's difficult for Americans to understand, I can't imagine my relatives in South Boston or an auto worker in Michigan or somebody who's got a tech job in Silicon Valley, do they really care about an American empire, which we don't have anymore? But at the average Russian, you know, who makes a few kopecks a week, it's still at least I'm part of a great country, a great society, and we stand for something and we're important. And that means something to them.
Yeah. What are their weaknesses?
Well, for example, I write in the book, Putin, it's a criticism of Trump, by Trump, of Biden, but very few people, senior people, get fired in the Russian system, right? Think about all the debacles that occurred in Ukraine, and not just the obvious ones that got a lot of press, like their Black Sea flagship is now on the floor of the Black Sea, you know, destroyed by, which they lie about. But it's just, almost incomprehensible. And I think I suggest this in the book. It's hard to believe, you know, as Eric knows, our former boss, he had a much more senior level than I. Secretary Rumsfeld would occasionally refer to the United States and the United States government as a cheap hamburger stand when we can't get out of our own way. But think about the number of Russian soldiers who were debilitated by frostbite because they hadn't prepared for war in Ukraine in February. They ordered their military to entrench in the Chernobyl zone, exposing their soldiers to serious number of soldiers to radiation poisoning. The number of generals who've been killed, including one not that long ago. I once said to my friend and fellow Bostonian, Mark Milley, I said, any one of these things, Mark, and your head would be on a platter. And yeah, they've replaced some generals and admirals, but it took a long time for Shoigu to be moved out. It's difficult for them. They can't admit mistakes. There's no accountability. There's no transparency. And that is, they think, a strength, but it's a short-term strength. It's a long-term weakness. And the Russian people know that. So they're not fooling anybody. And people ultimately get the word, many do, the sophisticated one, you know, what happened to the Moskva? What happened, you know, to Uncle Ivan? Was it really a motorcycle accident and his body was incinerated so we don't have it anymore, we couldn't have a funeral? Or was he in his cabin in the Moskva and is he now on the bottom of the Black Sea? You know, it's a system that is not, it's why Russian, and I think this is a great tragedy of Russia, and it pains me because it permeates their society. So they could be making a huge, helping to make advances for humankind. For example, during the pandemic, biomedical research, pharmaceutical research, they are hugely talented people. But their science establishment, it was hijacked, right, to create this Sputnik V vaccine that wasn't properly tested. There were so many ways that Russia and Russians could make life better for humanity, but they're corrupted and co-opted by this government in the Kremlin that turns everything to the use of the state. And I say in the book, you know, I used to repeat to my colleagues that the thought that occurred to me was, there's nothing sacred in Russia, whether it's everything is an instrument of the state, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Aeroflot, you name it. Roscosmos, they are instruments of the state and the FSB and the Kremlin.
Ambassador, you
know, that's not a strength. That is a weakness.
That's a weakness. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as you note in your memoir, it's a tradition as ambassadors leave post that they get to do a valedictory cable. And you also observe quite correctly that having a good subject line in your cable is very important in order to get it read at senior levels. And, you know, as someone who used to be the chief of staff to the deputy secretary, I know that when you were in your position as in D, that you probably looked at some cables because they had a good catchy subject line. And you wanted to give you never got to write your valedictory cable because of circumstances. But you say in the memoir that had you had a chance to do it, you would have appropriated a title from V.I. Lenin, What Is to Be Done. So tell our listeners and viewers, if you would, you know, sort of, had you had the opportunity to do that valedictory cable, what would the elements of it have been? What would have been in it?
So the theme would have been, and this is channeling my South Boston background, my theme would have been, buck up, buttercup, pull up your pants, we're at war, let's get to work. Because the Russians, and I know you both know this, travel in Eastern Europe, you travel to Warsaw, to Vilnius, Riga, Tallinn, Prague. As deputy secretary, leaders from the top down saying, Mr. Secretary, you don't understand. We're already in a hybrid war with the Russians, what they're doing to us. And we in the United States, it gets back to my earlier point about why OFM, the Office of Foreign Missions, they don't understand. They think we're at peace. And by our standards, yeah, we're at peace, but not by the Russian standards. And the Russians it's not just cyber and election interference and disinformation. It's old-fashioned KGB, NKVD tactics. And I guarantee I'll make a prediction. I'm not good at political predictions, so I never, ever since I bet wrong on George H.W. Bush in 1992, I've been loath to make political predictions. But something similar to what happened in Salisbury and in Berlin with the Tiergarten murder, that's going to happen here. I guarantee it. And it will be something that, you know, if it gets sufficient publicity and it is investigated thoroughly so that the Mexican, the Bolivian, the Cambodian, who was used indirectly by the FSB to murder someone in Miami or Boston or Los Angeles, who is the FSB in particular, or the other security services, or more generally, the Kremlin has a grudge against, they'll do it. He'll do it. I guarantee it. I've seen it. I've seen enough to convince me with matters that I can't discuss openly, they're up to it. They'd do it. Just as they shot, you know, they sent an FSB colonel in broad daylight to assassinate a Chechen in Berlin, in a park, in front of a bunch of innocent people, just bystanders, children included.
Yeah, and there's been
they're at war with us.
And there's been plenty of reporting in the Financial Times and elsewhere about the uptick in clearly Russian-linked sabotage operations, the DHL explosive packages, et cetera. So, yeah, I completely agree with you that this is...
It's a war, and we don't get it. We really, the United States government, some people in the FBI, they get it. Some people at the agency, State Department, I'll give you... Elliot, back to your point, I did an event with the Kennan Institute yesterday, and it was it's the 50th anniversary of Kennan and James Billington and Frederick Starr, the founding of of the Kennan Institute. And so there were a number of folks. I was the youngest on this video program by about 20 years. And it was interesting to see how some of those old Soviet specialists were still, I mean, there's still a longing for something better. We were working for something better coming out of the Soviet Union, coming from Moscow. You can't give up hope. And I said, that is the one thing. My editor took this out of the book because he thought it was too theological. The most important thing that Putin and the FSB and the SVR and the GRU, what they want to do is crush hope. Why do they create division and sow chaos? They want to crush hope and have us think that we're just like them. We do the same things that they do. It's just one big game. It's like Michael Corleone and the guy, you know, you're part of the same hypocrisy, Senator, he says to Senator Geary at the beginning of Godfather 2. We're not, at least I'm not, and the people I work with, we're not. But, you know, so I've got an appointment as a distinguished fellow at Georgetown, and I when I started my first day, I joked with some Jesuits, because the Russians call us, say that we in the West, we're infected with Satan, we're devils, etc. I said I needed to come and obviously take a post at Georgetown because I might need an exorcism from one of the Jesuits. And so there's a line in the book and in the movie where the young Jesuit and the senior Father Lancaster Marin, the exorcist himself, the young Jesuit asked the senior Jesuit, why would Satan possess a young innocent girl like this? And he says, it's to destroy hope, to make us think that we're all base, and even a young innocent girl can young innocent child can behave in that base, awful way. And that's what Putin and the FSB at heart are about. And my editor thought that was far too theological and scary. And he said, enough references to the devil.
In the world in which we live, there are never enough references to the devil, you know, because he really is still out there. I mean, I think
I will quote Justice Scalia. He absolutely, the late great.
Yeah. Well, C.S. Lewis also.
You bet.
He got into a lot of trouble because he said that, look, the devil really exists. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, I just hope that some of what you're saying is sinking in, you know, in interactions you've had with states since you've left. Do you see any change in the bureaucracy? And
I mean, the war really, you know, so what I was describing in particular, the most frustrating episodes I had occurred before February 24th, 2022. After February 24th, there was very little engagement with the MFA at that point from my standpoint, and we were the instructions were to keep the place open, to keep a presence there, do the best you can on reporting, but you know, with that's the most we can hope for. What I was willing to do, I guess, to put a finer point on it, was I was willing to call the Russians bluff in that we were engaged in tit-for-tat diplomatic expulsions, not giving visas to certain Russian officers. They're not, and if we kept going that way, we have fewer officers, we have fewer Americans at Embassy Moscow. They have more at Embassy Moscow. Or Embassy Washington, in their mission, their bilateral mission to the United States. I'm not even touching their mission to the UN, which is, of course, another great platform for the security services. Even if
nest of spies.
Yes, absolutely. And not just their mission embedded into the UN staff, which is, I mean, it's a real problem. I'm just focusing on, because it makes heads explode, at the State Department if I start challenging something that's going to impact the UN, the host country agreement, et cetera. I mean, everybody, they get the vapors over that.
Oh,
and
God.
I run into that myself. Yeah, I consider myself part of they and us. But for just focused on the bilateral mission and reciprocity, I wanted to say to the Russians, we have, pick a number. We have 180 accredited U.S. diplomats at our mission to Russia. You have 270. What's wrong with that picture? You preach reciprocity. Let's have reciprocity. I need X number of visas, or we're going to expel an equivalent number so we get to the same number. And the Russians would say, nope, not going to do it. And if you expel any Russian who's expelled, we'll expel an American. And we get to a point, it's not zero. You know, it's under 100, but not much, where we can't continue to safely operate. And our side says, well, we can't risk losing the mission. Well, who says we're going to? Well, the Russians, they're not going to close. They're not going to. Putin doesn't want to lose his embassy in Washington. Call their bluff. And you know what? If they're willing to close both embassies and smother their mission to the United Nations. Have the courage of your convictions. And so I start talking like this, right? And people, oh, geez, there he goes again.
I'm all for it.
All I can say, I mean, Eric will get the last question, but I want to say two things. First, American foreign policy would be a lot better if they had just handed over to South Boston.
Well, I think the whole world would be. But
as a Bostonian, I'm telling everybody that, and I think you've given evidence of that. The other thing I want, on a more serious note, I just want to say before we sign off, you know, you and your family sacrificed a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. I'll leave that story for the book, but I just want to say thank
you. Oh, you're kind.
And I admire you for it.
Can I have a quick South Boston footnote? You'll appreciate this, Elliot. I came back from my first, of course, I knew Secretary Blinken, having succeeded him as deputy. We became friends. My first meeting with him as secretary, face-to-face, I was back on leave in April of 21. And we were talking about Putin, and the question I would always get is, what's he really like? And I was trying to come up with some, you know, I'd put this all in cables and something new. What could I say to him that hasn't already been said to him before? And I said, you know, the way I think of him, he's a Slavic Jimmy Bulger. Oh. And he looks at me and says, who's Jimmy Bulger? I said, well, in South Boston, if you wanted your nose to stay in its proper place, you didn't use that W word and call him Whitey. He's like, yeah, this ambassador is a little kooky here. I mean, he is kind of a hothead. So anyway.
It probably says something about the three of us that we all get the reference.
Yeah.
Ambassador Sullivan, we are running out of time, but I do have one final question I'd like you to just address briefly, which is President Trump has said, of course, that he wants to end the war in 48 hours. A lot of discussion now up in the air about, you know, negotiating a solution to,
right,
to Ukraine. How do you assess Putin's readiness to actually negotiate, or is he just looking for a fig leaf on a capitulation by Ukraine?
Yeah, no, I think it's the latter, unfortunately. And I would, if I were in charge, and I'm not, or even providing advice, which I'm not, I'm too far deep in the deep state. I would ban the use of the N-word, and N-word I mean negotiate. Which is not to say that we shouldn't talk to the Russians. As soon as you tell our colleagues, our former colleagues and friends in the State Department or in the USG, we're going to negotiate with the Russians, they will start preparing a negotiating strategy and good faith gesture here. And they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You don't understand. I'm only partially joking when I describe Putin as a Slavic Jimmy Bulger. I mean, there's no negotiations. He says this virtually every day. In fact, he said it within the last 24 hours, right? With the call that he had with Scholz. Yeah, I'm ready to negotiate. It's just those negotiations have to take into account the realities on the ground in two things. The realities on the ground in Ukraine and Russia's security needs. He's been saying the same thing since before the war started. He will never, ever, ever change those war aims. He just won't. And people don't understand it. They're looking for off-ramps. It just, it's not the way he operates. It's not the way they operate. They will never, ever surrender those war aims. So people then say, well, how can you cut yourself off from the Russians? I'm not saying that. I talk to the Russians. I tell them things, sometimes more in sorrow than in anger, or sometimes genuinely angry when they commit massive war crimes. I tell them things. We need to talk to them, but negotiate? Soon as you use that N-word, we're starting down the wrong path.
Ambassador John Sullivan, you have done great service to the nation, as my colleague said. We're grateful that you spent some time with us today. I commend your memoir, Midnight in Moscow, to all of our listeners and viewers. And I hope, actually, as this continues to unfold, because, as a commission that I recently co-chaired said, unlike the national defense strategy, Russia's not an acute challenge. It's, as you said, going to be a chronic and persistent one. I hope you'll come back and join us on Shield of the Republic in the future. But thank you so much for spending time with us.
I'd love to. It's been my pleasure. And since I'm in Miami, I will again draw on the Godfather. And I wish I were back in government. But like Hyman Roth, I'm just a retired investor living on a pension. So I have time and would be delighted to participate in future editions.
Thank you.
Thanks.